This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. For nearly a year, Florida police and sheriff's officers have had so-called red flag legislation at their disposal. It allows them to ask a judge to temporarily remove guns from the hands of people deemed a threat to themselves or others. So just how effective has the law proven so far? And what about arguments that it could infringe First Amendment rights? WLRN's Danny Rivero joins us to explain. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
One of the things that happened after the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland last year was a piece of legislation was passed that was designed to make it easier for police and law enforcement to make sure that people didn't have access to guns if they weren't in a fit state to have those guns, so-called red flag laws. Over the last 12 months, what has been the process of those laws rolling out and how have you seen them used?
So what I've found through my reporting is that in some places, the local police are taking this very seriously. And you know, I work out of Miami. So Miami-Dade County Police have created an entire separate unit that's fully dedicated to this. And the same thing as in Broward County, where, of course, the Marjory Stoneman Douglas tragedy happened. They have an entirely new unit that's completely dedicated to this called the Threat Management Section. And that's the section that if they receive a threat that someone submitted on social media, if they have reports that someone has been, you know, talking about committing an act of violence in the public, these are the people that are now totally dedicated to talking to that person, and in many cases issuing a court order and taking these people to court in order to issue what they call a risk It's called a risk – shoot, hold on.
That's fine.
Here it is.
That's fine.
Yeah. So they take these people to court and they issue what's called a risk protective order. And in order for that to go into effect, they actually have to go before a judge and tell the judge, you know, this is what we hear. Here's some evidence of what we've seen. And, you know, according to our assessment, this person should not have access to firearms. And – so if the judge agrees with that, it can be effective for up to a year at a time. And if you own a gun and you're issued a risk protective order, that means that gives the police the ability to go into your home and take your guns away. And it'll also put you on a state list that you can't buy firearms over that dedicated time period. So over the since this law passed in March, according to the records I have, the state records, 937 of these orders have been granted by courts across the state. So almost 1,000, because that number I have is only through November.
Is there some time pressure for law enforcement agencies to be able to remove guns from somebody if they're deemed to be a threat to themselves or others? And I'm wondering if that's sort of built into the legislation too.
Yeah, so there's actually two kinds of these risk protective orders. One is a temporary one that's effective for 2 weeks, and so that's usually the first step that an officer will take if they see someone that has a big red flag. They'll take it to court and they'll say, hey, we need a temporary basically order to issue onto this person for 2 weeks that they shouldn't have access to firearms because we just saw them issue an imminent threat, you know, to shoot up a bank or something like that. And, you know, they can extend that, but then, you know, the big goal if someone is really posing a serious threat, according to the police, is they take them and they get these orders that are valid for up to a year. So there's a kind of the short-term solution, and then there's the longer-term solution, which is up to a year at a time.
I'm wondering, is this something which folks who have been advocating for more protection for domestic violence and domestic abuse sufferers have said this is a law that could help those folks too?
Yeah, absolutely it is. I mean, one, you know, pretty common thread with mass shootings, as we see them not just in Florida but across the country, is there's often an element of a history of domestic violence. And actually, here in Miami-Dade County, these court hearings that happen in order to issue these red flag laws, those happen in the domestic violence court. So there's definitely a very close relationship with these two things. You know, for the story I did, I actually talked to an individual who was flagged by the police that he should get one of these orders so he can't buy a gun for a year's time. But that came about because of threats that, you know, he made threats towards family members inside of his home. And, you know, the police became aware of it and they said, okay, well, because of the nature of these threats, we're not going to necessarily arrest you right now, but we're going to make sure you don't have access to these firearms. So very much that's domestic violence is closely tied to this.
And it's up to the judge in these cases to decide whether or not this is a real threat and whether or not this kind of action needs to be taken.
Exactly. So the police officers would go before the judge. There is an element of due process for this, which is very important for gun rights. You know, the right to own a firearm is a fundamental civil right in the United States. You can't just take someone's guns and not have due process. So what this law did is that it created the process, and the process is you have a hearing, you might have a temporary hearing, and then, you know, you go before the judge, you plead your case, and then the judge has to make a determination, and they can't just extend it arbitrarily. You have to go before a judge and plead your case. And from the numbers that we're looking at from the state, you know, there are a lot of hearings that follow up, and some people, you know, they're found to be compliant with what the officers are asking and the court is asking. And so those original orders are actually rescinded at that point. And then, you know, if you had guns, you will get them back. And, you know, if you wanted to purchase a firearm, you can purchase it at that point.
What have you heard from police and other law enforcement agencies that you've talked to in the course of your reporting, Danny Rivera, about how effective they think this new law is?
What I've heard from police and also just people that work within the court system is that this was, you know, dramatically needed. This was a very needed piece of the a tool in the toolbox, as one officer put it, for police to have. Because, you know, before this, police might be aware that someone has made thin threats and they're going to a shooting range, right after issuing one of these threats and you know, practicing their marksmanship skills, and the police could kind of go talk to these people, but they didn't have they might be able to confiscate guns just for a couple days if it's very imminent, but the process for actually withholding someone's access to firearms for an entire year, that just did not exist. So, you know, the officers I've talked to are saying that, you know, thank God we now have the authority to do this, and there's a process for it, and it's not just they're not winging it anymore. They actually have it prescribed in the state law what they can and can't do, and they have to go before a judge, and you know, they feel that it's very fair, and they feel that by having this process, they're keeping the community safer, because, you know, some of these people perhaps shouldn't have access to guns.
I imagine there are people though who might say, look, this is dangerously close to infringing on people's Second Amendment rights. What have you heard from people who think this probably isn't such a good idea?
So notably, the law that this was part of, the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School Public Safety Act, that's been challenged by the NRA, but not for this part of the law. Gun rights groups have really been quiet on this part. You know, they've been pushing back against the part of the law that raised the purchasing age from 18 to 21. So that's really been the biggest point of contention. But I have not actually heard much from anyone about, you know, this kind of red flag law. Right after this passed, Marco Rubio, our senator, was floating the idea of having a version of this on the national level. It didn't really go anywhere, but we're only about a year into this. So I think we'll see as knowledge of what's going on kind of behind the scenes quietly in a lot of police departments comes to light. And, you know, you hear from officers talking about how effective this program might be. You know, maybe we'll hear more kind of pushback as knowledge of this program and this process starts to be more known. But as of now, I haven't really heard really almost any negative public statements. You know, it's one of those things where public safety seems to be, first and foremost.
And one thing you'll also hear around the aftermath of mass shootings is people talk about the need for better mental health care and making sure people are getting the kind of psychological help they need if they need help. Is this law, does it in some way address some of those concerns?
So I would say it's the way that it's being interpreted, and the you know, some police departments are using it as a way to really tackle some of those other parts of this, you know, whole, you know, ecosystem of someone's mental health and their access to firearms. So what The Miami-Dade County Police Department, they actually started a new unit called the Threat Assessment Section. And, you know, a large part of that is issuing these orders. But then they've also kind of turned that office in itself into almost like what I call a social work branch of the police department. So they're actually, you know, making calls to people that issue threats. They're getting permission to talk to their therapists and their psychiatrists, you know, following up with them almost on a patient doctor basis. And you know, connecting them with all these social services to make sure that these people who need help are stabilized and that they're receiving the attention that they need. So they saw kind of the red flag provision in here as a way to they built a department around that. And in Broward County, they've largely done the same. You know, they make house calls to people that come on their radar. They kind of check up on them and say, hey, here's why you're on our radar. You know, are you on medications right now? Are you going to your doctor or whatnot? And they do in Broward County, they do more kind of typical police surveillance and they do arrest people in that unit. But from what I've heard from police officers, they're trying to take a holistic approach to this. You can't just arrest your way out of troubled people. You know, people are troubled, and when someone's troubled, sending them to jail might be the opposite of the good thing. You know, that might be bad for someone. So they're trying to take a more holistic approach to it.
One final question, Danny Rivero. Obviously, this is a somber week for the Parkland community and for South Florida in general, sort of remembering the lives lost a year ago at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. I wonder if you can kind of sum up the kind of general mood of the community as the week sort of rolls on.
Yeah, I mean, for obvious reasons, it's all very somber. It's not a good anniversary. It's kind of a marking of the passage of time, but it's also reflective, I would say. It's you know, people taking this moment to look back on this tragedy. You know, it's something that what for my generation was Columbine, for this generation now is Marjory Stoneman Douglas. And you know, here in South Florida, we're kind of at ground zero. So it's a very reflective, somber look, and people are still very angry. You know, they want the superintendent of schools here fired. You know, Sheriff Israel was just fired by our new governor, Ron DeSantis, a couple weeks ago, and people were very happy with that. So there's still a lot of lingering anger, but you know, as this anniversary is here this week, it's very somber and reflective, I would say.
Well, Danny Rivero, reporter for WLRN, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Still to come on Intersection, how staff and students at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School are coping 1 year on.
I mean, I find myself looking at the calendar a lot now and just kind of hoping for February 15th at this point. We just want to try to get through this.
Intersection is back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. It's been a tough year for students and staff at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. From the Education Desk this week, we hear from AP Politics teacher Jeff Foster about what's changed for him in the last 12 months and about the political activism among his students. I spoke to Jeff Foster last week. Jeff Foster, thank you so much for joining us.
Happy to be here.
First of all, how are things at the school, like almost a year on now? Is it still fairly raw there, or have things settled back to kind of normal?
There's been a lot of ebbs and flows over the last year, and actually, since we're talking a week before the anniversary, the anxiety's definitely been ratcheted up in the last, I mean, since the calendar flipped to February, things have definitely, it's tensious. There's a lot of tension again. I was actually at a soccer game last night, and the electricity went down. The power grid went down during the game. It was a night game, and you know, the stadium was pretty packed. It's a playoff game, and you know, everything just went off, and you could hear a pin drop, and people were immediately like tensed up. And for it to happen at any point over the last year, for it to happen, you know, this week was pretty crazy. But the kids got a hold of themselves pretty quick. But I mean, it's like I said, I'm not sure. You know, overall, we're doing better, I guess, to answer your question directly, but it's getting tough now that it's this week. A lot of kids are going to, you know, just miss all next week. A lot of A lot of teachers are traveling next week. We do have off school next Thursday, the 14th. The kids can stay home. The teachers are required to show up. We can use, obviously, a sick day, which if we'd like, which we're a little bit upset about because I don't know why we just can't stay home as well. But most of us have things planned with each other, our families or our close friends that day just to sort of get through it. And I think there's just a collective, you know, thought if we can just get past the 14th, then things will really start to heal. I mean, just today, actually this morning, and we've been talking a lot about it, as I said, as the calendar turned, just today I finally took off all the bracelets I've been wearing to honor, you know, my fallen colleagues and students. And the next thing off is, you know, we wear lanyards, and the lanyards with the picture of my former student Carmen Shentrop on it and other things. I think I'm going to take those off after the 14th. And not that we're forgetting any of these people, but I think it's time to maybe try to close the chapter and move on with the next chapter.
It, just back to the soccer game you were talking about, do you feel like are people at the school still kind of on edge? Like if there's a fire drill or something like that, does it set people off? Are people worried about that kind of thing?
Luckily, we've done some stuff with the fire department to where we've been able to miss the last couple of fire drills. We've given them literature, the kids, and they've signed it with their parents to say that they're informed of everything. But we still have to do the code red drills and the code black drills. And every time, and you know, the principal calls home the day before and says, like, tomorrow between the hours of 10 and 10:30, we're going to have a code red drill. You know, don't call your kid. Don't call the school. It's just a drill. We will call you again tomorrow, a half hour before, and let you know when it's completed. But please don't interrupt the drill. And we've marked safety zones in our class. But the kids, you know, a lot of the kids still don't react well when that happens. I mean, you know, we have to go to the corner and sit down. And a lot of these kids are reliving exactly where they were last year. I mean, obviously, it was a lot more intense the first couple months this year, and things have settled down. I mean, it's hard to even convey what happened during the first planned and unplanned. We had two or three unplanned fire drills. Kids pulled, you know, the alarms earlier this year, and our kids, I mean, just broke down completely. Kids just fell apart, and that's why we asked the fire department if we could, you know, get rid of some of these drills, and luckily they acquiesced and allowed us to do it, but it's been tough. I mean, you know, every child's in a different place. Every teacher's in a different place, but the pain still exists, and the PTSD is real.
Is there a playbook for how to come back from something like this? And you're talking about an entire school population, right? And then the extended families of everyone. I mean, there's a lot of people hurting from this. Like, is there? And it sounds like it's been a bit of trial and error over the last 12 months. But do you feel like you kind of knew what to expect in the immediate aftermath and the months that followed?
Probably not. We have been given, you know, a lot of resources. We've spoken a lot to Sandy Hook people, to Columbine people, principals, teachers, you know, even some students. You know, at the end of last year when Santa Fe happened, I and a couple of my colleagues personally reached out that day to teachers and said, you know, we're here for you. I mean, not that we're experts, but we've obviously had some experience now. So whatever you guys need. You know, our kids, the Never Again kids, went out there to offer whatever help they could offer as well. But you feel like every time you take a couple steps forward, something happens to sort of set you back again. Like even this, after the holiday, we came back, and the day back is a planning day. And instead of having a normal planning day where we just go in and sort of sit around and, you know, just reset and get ready for the next semester, we had a full day of healing. And we had some people from Columbine, and we had different classes where we were learning different techniques still. And a lot of us, including myself, felt like that set us back again because we just came off this two-week break to where we were away from it all. And instead of just coming back and maybe easing into the semester like we normally do, we're thrust right back into these exercises where it's like, oh, yeah, you're the school that had the mass shooting. Let's deal with that again. And, I mean, a lot of people took, you know, the staff especially took big steps backwards after that. And, you know, that's only a month out now, you know, month and a week ago. So, I mean, one of my really good friends who, you know, was doing a nice job of healing, and he was in the building that day, building 12. He had to go home the next day because when he saw his kids that next day, it just brought him back to when he came back the semester last year. And he teaches a class that flips with another teacher. And some of the kids that he flipped with the other teacher were in a classroom that got shot and got killed. So he immediately like went back to that, and we just talked yesterday about it. He said he doesn't think he would have reacted that way if we didn't have that first day back to sort of slap us in the face. And I know the intention was good, but I think it worked counter to what they wanted. So yeah, it's trial and error to say the least. We're trying our best, I don't think anybody's an expert. We lean on people that have gone through this. We lean on each other, you know, and we just try to see what works. I mean, even like I said before with my bracelets, I just felt like it was time to get rid of them. And I mean, you know, just staring at the six bracelets on my arm every day, obviously it's a constant reminder, and it doesn't mean I'm going to forget. It just means as you trying to just, you know, put it in the rearview mirror a little bit so you can sort of move on with your life beyond February 14th.
What have you found the most helpful for you, Jeff Foster, over the last 11 months or so, as far as trying to kind of make some sense of what happened and move on?
For me, being directly involved with the movement and being, I guess, lucky enough to be the mentors of a lot of those kids, that kept me busy at least. My family's been great. My wife is a teacher as well, and you know, she immediately took off in the aftermath and was there for me whatever I needed. And even directly afterwards, when we were going to just that, as I unfortunately gave it the moniker the parade of funerals we went to. You know, we have a very close social studies department, and we bonded. You know, a couple of our friends got shot, survived. One of my friends, best friends, got shot and killed. We all bonded together and were there for each other, no matter whose funeral it was or what we were or where we were that day. And I think just being immersed in the movement first, and then just taking time out with my colleagues and realizing, you know, like this day, you know, Mr. Marino might be hurting, so let's be there for him. The next day, we might need to be there for me or be there for, and we just kind of taken turns and realized who was in a bad spot. And on my end, as you could probably tell from this conversation, I don't mind talking about things. And I think for me, and this goes for a lot of us as well, just being able to not relive it, but recount it and try to just make sense of it. And even in the classroom, I mean, I never had an issue talking. And again, I teach upper level seniors, so that they might be a little bit more, you know, equipped to deal with it. But even, you know, as late as 2 days ago, we were talking about February 14th in my class and the ramifications of it. I mean, it just, you know, in the middle of any lecture, you just, you know, it just evolves into a conversation about it. And instead of quashing it, I just allow the kids to talk. And I feel if it goes, you know, too far one way, I'll stop it. But most of the time, the kids find it therapeutic to talk about it. And we have a lot of counselors on staff. We have an entire wellness center that was created after the event, and some kids use it and some kids are being helped by it. But I think a lot of the kids are just being helped by, whether it's their English class or their social studies class or whatever class, but there's a lot of open discussion and just being able to articulate what happened that day and how we can collectively best, you know, get through it.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. I'm Matthew Petty talking to Jeff Foster. He's an AP politics teacher at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School. Jeff, it's interesting. It sounds like it's kind of changed a little bit the way you teach in a way, or at least your approach or your attitude to the way you tackle classes, or just kind of the way those classes evolve, right?
Maybe a little bit. I mean, I've always had a pretty, you know, good class. I've always been very open with the kids. I've been teaching this subject for 20 years, and I'm, you know, kids want to take my class. They've heard about me from their brothers and sisters and cousins and hell, it's their parents to some degree. And, you know, like I said, I'm just fortunate to have the best kids in the school. So when you have those kids that are as bright as they are and that are motivated as they are, you know, sometimes just getting them to open up, you know, allows them to make decisions and come up with. I mean, I wasn't in the room when March for Our Lives was founded. I'd like to believe I had a hand in maybe inspiring them a little bit, but they did that on their own. You know, there was no, hey, Mr. Foster, what should we do? It was, hey, Mr. Foster, we did this. How can you help us? You know, that sort of stuff. So it's, you know, I think you, the curriculum's still the same, but sure, I guess you're correct in a manner that we do have to allocate time and be maybe a little bit more, I mean, I'd like to believe I was a compassionate person beforehand, but obviously, as I mentioned before, every there's a different situation for every kid. You know, where in the past, you know, if a kid was late or a kid missed the test or a kid, you know, it was a cut and dried policy, but now you found out he was in the wellness center for 4 hours or that they were celebrating or whatever with you know, an anniversary of someone that passed away or got shot or whatever else. And you obviously have to be a lot more mindful of, I don't want to say excuses, but reasons why something happened. And you can't just jump to conclusions and be like, oh, this kid's just, you know, he slept in, so he's late. No, he's late because, you know, he had a dream last night and was sweating all night and couldn't get out of bed. So it's a different world we live in for sure.
When you talk about being involved in the movement, you're talking about the March for Our Lives.
Sure.
I mean, do you get the sense that the kids who were so motivated and so kind of politically active in the months after the shooting are still at that level of kind of motivation and interest politically?
100%. We're still traveling over the country. We're still, I mean, obviously there's no election coming up now, but I mean, we had some of the parents in D.C. today at a hearing for gun control. Tomorrow, I'm bringing four of the original members that spoke in Washington, D.C. to a middle school in Palm Beach County, which is one county north of ours, to talk to young activists that are in middle school to motivate them. You know, we have like a day where I'm actually, it's very reminiscent of the Tallahassee trip. I'm borrowing my wife's minivan. I'm bringing it to school. We have a half day tomorrow, so when school ends, they're all jumping in my car. We're going to grab some pizza, and then we're heading up north to go, you know, inspire 7th and 8th graders to become the next wave of activists. So they're constantly, I'd say this month has been slower for them, but from last March from February, I guess, until January, there wasn't a weekend or a week where, you know, 2, 3, 4, 5 of them, at least our core group at Douglas, weren't out of town or doing something to either motivate someone to vote or push a candidate or push a policy issue somewhere. And now, obviously, as you know, I mean, the movement has been just incredible. It's nationwide now. And, I mean, whether it's me getting a phone call from David Hogg at midnight on the eve of him meeting with Nancy Pelosi or whether it's, you know, just the kids just need to talk to me just to get a laugh about something. I mean, it's funny. My phone will ring at any hour of the night, and I have the announcement on their phone where it says someone's name, and I'll hear the name, and I'll just kind of laugh and roll over and wake up. And if it's David, for instance, who tends to call a lot late night, he'll say, "I'm glad you were up." And I said, "Actually, I've been in bed since 10:30, and we'll just kind of laugh. But then, you know, he wants to talk for an hour, and I'll get out of bed and talk to him for an hour. I mean, I'm like I said before, I'm honored to be someone that they lean on, and I'm happy to give my advice when they ask for it.
There has been some pushback against those young student activists, though, right? I mean, not everybody is happy with what they're saying and happy with the policies they're pushing for or even their motivations in some cases.
I mean, there's even some rancor within the school. You know, I mean, a lot of the kids that were in the 1200 building that day, which for those who don't know is the building where the shooting took place. I mean, there's kids there that feel like it's unfair that the coverage that, you know, an Emma Gonzalez or a David Hogg or a Ryan Deitch or an Alex Wind or any of these other kids got, because, you know, they weren't in the line of fire, and they're like, you know, pseudo celebrities now. And, you know, and I have to say, listen, they didn't ask for it, and they're not doing this to become popular or get Twitter followers. They're trying to do this to ensure that this never happens at any other school. You know, I'm sorry that, you know, you didn't get to meet President Obama or Speaker Pelosi, but that's not why they're doing this. You know, there's a bigger calling for it. But I mean, obviously that's just in the school, but outside of the school, I mean, I have friends of mine that are extremely conservative that, you know, will write things to me on Facebook and Twitter and even text messages, and to where my wife has said, just drop that person as a friend if they can't figure out that, you know, all politics aside, this is something entirely different. Because, mm-hmm. I mean, as has been reported many times, I'm a registered Republican. So for a Republican to be, you know, sort of, you know, part of this movement is exasperating to some of my Republican friends.
But as you say, not everyone thinks that gun control is the answer, right? There are some people who are unhappy with that.
Even some of the parents, you know, I mean, the Pollock family, which, you know, they lost Meadow, believes that, and Kyle Kashuv, who's become very, very popular for meeting with President Trump directly, one of our students, believe they have this fix-it campaign that's more about, you know, hardening schools, which, you know, I don't necessarily disagree with either. But I mean, you got to look at all aspects of this debate and to claim that, you know, the AR-15, you know, if the kid would have had a pistol, it would have been the same damage is ridiculous. So, I mean, there's, I don't think anybody's entirely right, but I mean, anybody that's looking to solve the problem, obviously, I'm willing to listen to at least.
What about some of those other aspects, though? I mean, there was legislation pushed through to, for example, increase the number of school resource officers, or in some cases, arm other school staff at schools across Florida. Do you feel like things are more secure in schools, or has there been a change to make you feel safer at Marjory Stoneman Douglas?
It's hard for us because we have so much security now. I mean, we have security guards every 3 feet you walk. We have school resource officers, you know, in spades at our school right now, and you feel almost bad about it because, you know, I have a lot of friends throughout the county being a 20 plus year teacher, and, you know, they've still got the one SRO, school resource officer, working for them, and meanwhile we got 9 in our school at times, you know. So yeah, we're we feel very secure at our school. You know, the gates are locked all the time and we're checking badges and the kids are, there's no wands or anything at our school yet. But I mean, it's definitely infinitely more safer today than it was, you know, February 13th or February 14th of last year. But I mean, at some point you can't just say, you know, you deserve X amount more than any other school just because we're the school that had the shooting. I mean, obviously we're going to beef up security next week because there, as we've been told consistently, there seems to be some, you know, it's every year, I guess, at Columbine, they get a threat around the day of the shooting on 420. So we're expecting something similar. And that's why we made sure the kids were not going to be at school next week during that time. But, I guess to answer your question, I feel safer. But, I mean, I don't know if I don't think the county's done enough to ensure that it could never happen again. I mean, all it takes is one crazed person with a plan. And it doesn't even have to be that, I don't think, precise of a plan to maximize the number of persons he or she kills.
What about the school board then? Because they came in for quite a lot of criticism, or the school district rather, for criticism over, you know, what led up to the shooting and things like that.
There's been a big calling to fire the school board head, the superintendent, the last, you know, 10 months, and especially recently. We've had three meetings. They tried to have one big meeting with Superintendent Runcie, and it was canceled because of security reasons, ironically. And then we've had three individual ones for each grade level, and there's one more tomorrow night. I went to the one last night, actually, briefly, before I went to the aforementioned soccer game. And all it is, it's really just a bitch session, and he just nods and says, we'll look into that, and nothing's really occurring. And even though people are calling for him to step down, he's not going to quit his job. Could they have made some decisions that would have been, you know, better for us? Most likely. I mean, but, you know, at the same time, with any event like this, generally if the person wants to accomplish, I mean, we could have mitigated what Nicholas Cruz did, but I don't think there's any way we could have necessarily stopped it outside of one of the security guys seeing it in time and making the code red call. I mean, I don't know how much you or your listeners know about exactly what have happened, but we've watched 20, 30 hours of testimony down here in special, you know, groups, that committees that have been formed, and we pretty much know the ins and outs of everything that happened. And there's no question it could have been avoided down here, but it would have taken, you know, the right person at the right time to call the code red or tackle the kid or whatever else. And we just had a confluence of events that led to, obviously, the horrific tragedy that happened. So, I mean, it's generally, if bad people want to do bad things, unfortunately, it usually happens.
And what about the notion of arming teachers? Where do you stand on that?
We talked about that, you and I, actually, with the one sheriff, I think, from Polk County, I believe, Grady.
Yeah, Grady Judd.
And I've seen him since. He was actually on one of the committees and did a nice job on the committee, actually. I'm still right where I was 11 months ago. I believe that, you know, arming teachers is not a good idea. Should they arm some security, maybe? Should we add extra personnel? For sure. But I don't think, you know, myself or my colleagues are ready to. I wouldn't. I mean, if I was forced to do it, I would do it, and I would, you know, train as best as I could train. But there's no, I mean, the odds of me being proficient in shooting a gun and knowing what to do, you know, with I don't know, six training sessions seems a little less likely than training someone who either is a, you know, an Army veteran or already with the police force or some kind of security force. So I don't think the idea is terrible. I just think it should go somewhere, you know, not directly to teachers, but maybe, you know, beef up the security with people that are more equipped to do it.
How are you going to be remembering the folks who died on the 14th of February? What are you going to do to mark the tragedy?
I'm really not sure yet. I mean, it changes every day. You know, like I said before, I have friends that are going out of town. I have friends that are planning on. One of my really good friends wants to like relive our day. Like I was with him, and he wants to like literally do like our evacuation. We did the evacuation, end up at the same place we ended up, and sort of just as we go, almost like talk through what happened minute by minute. And I don't know if that's healthy or not. I'm not sure. It might be for some. Personally, I don't know. I really don't have a definitive answer to that, probably until like the day I wake up on the 14th. We were talking about it today at lunch. I mean, part of me wants to just stay home that day and just go to the beach or go play golf or just do something to just kind of, I mean, I find myself looking at the calendar a lot now and just kind of hoping for February 15th at this point. We just want to try to get through this because we've marked so many dates leading up to this. You know, it's always, you know, whether it's on Facebook or Twitter, you know, it's 1 month on to the 17, it's 6 months on to the 17, it's 11 months on to the 17. And so, I mean, I'm sure we'll have a moment of reflection, if not the whole day of reflection. But, At the same time, I mean, we just can't keep living in this state where we just everything is about, you know, that day, you know, overcoming everything. I mean, again, well, I mean, it's Valentine's Day as well, which makes it difficult for, you know, a lot of us who have, you know, wives and families. I mean, I have a wife and two daughters, and we always have a great time on Valentine's Day. And I mean, I think they're all relegated to the fact that we're not going to do anything on Valentine's Day this year. You know, Dad's going to be figuring out how he's going to get through the day. So it's going to be interesting. Like I said, I have no definitive answer. I've changed my thoughts on what I'm going to do that day probably a dozen times since the calendar turned to February.
I'm wondering too, you know, in your conversations with your colleagues over the last 12 months, has anybody sort of expressed the idea that they'd rather not be a teacher anymore? Has it had that kind of, has it been to sort of that level of reassessing whether this is a good career to be in?
Funny you asked that, just today, one of my best buddies who's been teaching 15 years, he's a, I don't want to say what he does, because then anybody who hears this will know who teacher it was, said that he's really thinking about not coming back next year and changing his career path, and he's 15 years into teaching. So, you know, the statistics bear out that most of us aren't going to be here at our school probably within like 5 years. I think at one point Columbine had a 90% turnover within like 5 years. Those numbers might be inflated, but it's pretty high. So I personally believe I'll be at Douglas for another 15 years till I retire, but you know, we'll see. But it definitely makes you reassess things. I mean, it's you know, I mean, we've been given a lot of stuff in the last year, and we're appreciative of everything. And obviously that's you know, starting to slow down now. I mean, basically before I could have asked for anything. I could have called anybody and they would have, you know, done whatever they could do, whether it had to do with money or going somewhere or meeting somebody or, you know, getting into somewhere. And it's been nice, but you feel it's cheapened by the fact that every time whether I'm talking to you or whether I'm, you know, being lucky enough to bring Jimmy Fallon to graduation to speak to the kids, you're appreciative of it. But you say as you meet them, like, hey, it's great meeting you, but I wish we never spoke or met, because then 17 of my friends would be alive. You know, so it's, you know, there's a few that are retiring this year. There's, like I said, there's a handful that will definitely move on. But I think a lot of us are also, we're inexorably linked forever. And I mean, you know, just on how I feel and a lot of my friends feel, I think a lot of us feel like we're going to be, you know, we've, you know, hardened our bonds and we're going to be together for a long time at our school. We feel like we're going to be there for the kids, you know.
Finally, Jeff Foster, what's your message to listeners? What do you want them to be thinking about, or you know, what would your kind of message be to them if they want to express some support for folks at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas or anyone who's been through a situation similar to what you all experienced a year ago?
I mean, I think it's just important to kind of listen to the people that are going through it. I mean, you know, I think there's enough diversity in our group as to, you know, what's proper that day, that I don't think anything's off limits for us. I mean, I have friends that are at their jobs just wearing MSD Strong shirts. There's other people that have sent cards. There's other people that are, you know, organizing stuff for us, or, you know, whether it's an outing somewhere or, you know, I mean, just to take a moment and just to think about what happened. I mean, ultimately, we'd love for everybody to galvanize and try to change laws to, you know, make sure that no child anywhere in this country ever has to be, you know, shot while in school again. And that would be the best gift we could have. But, you know, anything that anybody wants to do just to remember our 17, you know, fallen angels, as we like to call them, would be great. I mean, we're going to struggle for the next week. And when it's over, you know, there'll be a lot of tears shed that day and a lot of hugging. But once it's over, hopefully we'll be able to not completely put it behind us, but at least get to the point where we're not marking every month with some other anniversary. So, yeah, anybody listening, if anything that, you know, even if it's a minute of your day, just to, you know, say a prayer for somebody, that would be nice as well.
Well, Jeff Foster, AP politics teacher at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks, man. I appreciate it, bud.
Still to come on Intersection.
We wanted to put a banner on site so that we could have our Orlando community write messages of love and support, and we can send it over to them so they can feel the love that we felt after our tragedy as well.
A symbol of support from Orlando to Parkland and two communities brought together by tragedy. Intersection is back in a minute. We'll be right back. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. In the aftermath of the shooting at Pulse nightclub in Orlando in 2016, the city received messages of support from around the country. Some of the most poignant were from other communities that had experienced the trauma of a mass shooting. Now Orlando is paying it forward. Victims of the shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland will be remembered at an event at the site of Pulse on Thursday, and a banner with messages of support will be sent from Orlando to Parkland. I spoke to Nicole Parker, the Events and Community Outreach Coordinator for the One Pulse Foundation, about how tragedy can bind communities together. So we're here at the wall that surrounds the nightclub, the temporary memorial, and obviously people in Orlando, Pulse is something that's indelible in people's memory from 2016, but there's also the sense of connection, right, between Orlando and other cities which have experienced similar tragedies, and Parkland being one of those. And this week is 1 year since the tragedy at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School. Talk to me a little bit about that, if you could, Nicole. I know there's something specific that folks are doing here. There's a banner. Tell me a little bit about that banner.
Yeah, so we here between the Pulse community and the Parkland community have an uncommon bond of loss. You know, we really can identify with each other as far as having something, a situation to this magnitude happen in our communities. And it was just very comforting for us at our 1 year mark and 2 year mark to see the ceremonies that were happening around the world and how many people that did not forget about this situation. And we just always want to make sure that the Parkland community knows that we are here, we understand them, and we will not forget.
There is that banner. What sort of things are people writing on that banner?
Just messages of love and support. It was so, so comforting for us that we received hundreds and hundreds of items. People left items here even before the interim memorial was open, when it was just a chain link fence. There were so many items and beautiful letters just of inspiration and just hoping that we kind of get through this. And we wanted to put a banner on site so that we could have our Orlando community write messages of love and support, and we can send it over to them so they can feel the love that we felt after our tragedy as well.
Do people come here, or have they been coming here seeking out the banner for Marjory Stoneman Douglas specifically, or just because they happen to be at the site of the nightclub and they just see it and they're like, okay, I'm going to write something on that?
I think it's a mixture of both. What you realize is in memorials and museums, they tend to be kind of a common space, a ground where if another tragedy happens, people feel comfortable to go to that space and really be able to reflect. And after Parkland, we saw people come to the Pulse site just to kind of sit there and, you know, reflect and really gather their thoughts. So we do see people who are maybe patrons of Pulse that come by, but we've also seen so many people come that just want to sign the banner and want to be able to give that message of support to Parkland. One of the most amazing things was when it was shortly after the tragedy, there was Parkland survivors and their parents that came actually to this site. And it was while the interim memorial was under construction, but they came to this site and it was a chance for Pulse survivors to meet Parkland survivors. And it was just such an amazing event full of love and support. And to see two individuals who may be from different communities but share that common bond of loss to just comfort each other and really say, I understand what you're going through and I'm here for you. It was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen.
Was that spontaneous? Was it something that that folks from the One Pulse Foundation said, okay, let's do this, let's invite those survivors and family members from Parkland up here, or did it just kind of evolve organically?
It was actually pretty spontaneous. Like, from what I remember, I know that we caught wind that they were coming down here on a certain date, so we tried to gather up as many survivors as we knew and that were wanting to come at that time, because everyone's on a different path of healing. So we got as many as we could to come down here and kind of just meet us, and they actually read the names of the 49 while they were on this site and left 49 roses as well, and we had some elected officials join us for that as well. It was absolutely amazing.
Those 1 year, 2 year, 3 year marks can be quite traumatic, right? I mean, they can really trigger some devastating memories and emotions for people. What sort of advice do you have to people who are either directly connected to the shooting in Parkland, or just live in that community and have a connection that way? What sort of advice would you give them this week, you know, leading up to that 1 year mark?
We just want them to know that they're not alone. When you hit your 1 year, 2 year, 3 year, and so on, it really, you can feel alone. You can feel isolated, like oh my gosh, we're here again, and why are we reliving this? But we want them to know that the Pulse community stands with them, the Orlando community stands with them, and we are here to support and always remember Parkland and Pulse and all the other tragedies.
If you turn that around too, is it tough for folks who are either survivors or people who have a connection to the shooting at Pulse? Is this a tough week for Pulse survivors too?
I would say yes, because while a lot of the survivors have really tried their best to get back to their normal life, it still is a sense of reminding. They're still reminded that what happened at Pulse happens other places, and that I feel like they can feel the grieving of the Parkland community and really realize I was there. I do remember that as far as Pulse survivors, they really can identify with them and say, listen, many people may not be able to understand what it's like to be in that situation, but the survivors definitely do.
And it's not just something that, you know, it's one day and it's done, or a few weeks, right? I mean, it's a process you have to go through, and there are many different things that you might not think about if you haven't had to experience that yourself.
Absolutely. And I think things come in waves as well. Speaking to different survivors, sometimes they're good, and there's definitely weeks that they're good and they're back on track, and then something just knocks you back down. And I just hope that the Parkland survivors and whole community really realize that don't be defeated. Understand that there will be ups and downs, and understand that there will be tough times, but it does get better.
Looking back on the last few years, what do you wish you'd done differently? Or are there some things that you might have kind of approached differently in your personal healing process, and also thinking about what the city of Orlando did to try and heal and come back from the tragedy?
I think personally, I didn't give myself time to grieve. I kind of looked at it as I was not there that night. So I looked at it as, for people who were directly in that situation or directly affected by it, they're the ones that, you know, can have the time to be a little upset or cry or things like that. And I don't think I ever gave myself that chance until probably after the second year. And then I really went home after that ceremony and I was like, I need to really process through this. So I really think that I would allow myself the time and the chance to process through, instead of trying to bottle it up and think like, just because I wasn't there doesn't mean that I can't grieve as well. And you hear it from working for the foundation. We hear it all the time that even though an individual wasn't there, they were directly impacted. When this happens in your backyard or in your city or in your community, there is no way to describe that feeling of loss and being scared and being vulnerable. And I just think it's okay to allow yourself to process whether you were there that night, knew somebody there, or just affected all around.
Thursday, the 1 year mark from the Parkland shooting, what's happening here at the Pulse Memorial?
Literally what we're going to be doing is simply we just have the banner there. So we're going to make sure that banner is signed, because we want to send them something that is completely filled. And we will be reading the names of the 17 victims and a moment of silence. But the biggest thing really is that we want individuals to come down to the interim memorial and please sign that banner. And it's up now, and they can sign it all the way until the 14th. And we really would love to just have a banner that's filled with messages of love to send back to Parkland.
Well, Nicole, thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Nicole Parker is the Events and Community Outreach Coordinator for the One Pulse Foundation. Support for Intersection comes from Advent Health and from our listeners. Education reporting on 90.7 News is brought to you by Helios Education Foundation. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. Our intern is Ashley Garrett. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And we're on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Follow me on Twitter at Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.